Welcome to NEJM This Week. I'm Dr. Lisa Johnson. This week, we discuss left atrial appendage closure for atrial fibrillation, oxygen strategies in respiratory failure, an all-oral treatment for acute myeloid leukemia, CAR T-cell therapy enabling kidney transplantation, and a case of a neuroepithelial tumor that developed after gene therapy. We review childhood vaccine hesitancy, follow a complex diagnostic case, and examine perspectives on corporatization in medicine, famine and war, and the future of healthcare systems. We also welcome you to participate in a new clinical decisions. You are the incoming director of a residency training program. Before the COVID-19 pandemic began in 2020, the program had conducted only in-person interviews, but since the start of the pandemic, all interviews for the program have been virtual. Although some faculty and residents have noted benefits to a virtual-only interview policy, others have argued for a return to in-person interviews. You are considering the potential benefits and harms of the two approaches and must decide whether to recommend continuing virtual-only interviews or returning to in-person interviews for the upcoming application cycle. Participate in forming community opinion by reading the vignettes and voting at nejm.org. Left atrial appendage closure or anticoagulation for atrial fibrillation by Shefal Doshi from the Cedars-Sinai Smith Heart Institute, Los Angeles, and co-authors. For patients with atrial fibrillation, the use of oral anticoagulant therapy to prevent stroke is limited by the risk of bleeding. Left atrial appendage closure is considered for patients who are unsuitable candidates for long-term anticoagulation, but its role in patients who are eligible for anticoagulants has not been established. In this trial, 3,000 patients with atrial fibrillation who were suitable candidates for anticoagulation were randomly assigned to receive either device-based left atrial appendage closure or non-vitamin K antagonist oral anticoagulant, NOAC, therapy. At 3 years, device-based left atrial appendage closure was non-inferior to NOAC therapy with respect to a composite of death from cardiovascular causes, stroke, or systemic embolism. Device-based left atrial appendage closure was superior to NOAC therapy for non-procedure-related bleeding at 3 years. Gregory Marcus from the University of California, San Francisco, asks in an editorial, given the long track record and robust evidence supporting the efficacy and safety of NOACs, why would an alternative that is only just as good even be entertained? One compelling argument is that the harms of anticoagulation may accrue uniquely among patients receiving NOACs over an extended period of time. Another clinical implication involves patient preference, which means that shared decision-making should be a central component in the management of atrial fibrillation. Owing to concerns that monetary incentives among operators may corrupt comprehensive discussions, organizations considering broadening indications may be wise to incorporate an independent third-party interlocutor to ensure that adequate information is communicated to prospective patients. Although the data in the current trial support expanding consideration of left atrial appendage closure for selected patients on a case-by-case basis, they are likely to be insufficient for a definitive declaration that this approach is as efficacious as conventional NOAC therapy in the great majority of patients with atrial fibrillation. High flow or standard oxygen in acute hypoxemic respiratory failure by Jean-Pierre Fra from the Centre Hospitalier Universitaire de Poitiers, France, and co-authors. Data have been needed about the effect of oxygen delivered through a high-flow nasal cannula, as compared with standard oxygen therapy, on intubation and mortality in patients with acute hypoxemic respiratory failure. In this trial, 1,110 patients who had acute hypoxemic respiratory failure were randomly assigned to receive high-flow oxygen or standard oxygen therapy. All the patients had a ratio of the partial pressure of arterial oxygen to the fraction of inspired oxygen of 200 or less, a respiratory rate of more than 25 breaths per minute, and pulmonary infiltrate on chest imaging. The primary outcome was death by day 28. Among these patients, the use of oxygen delivered through a high-flow nasal cannula did not significantly reduce mortality at day 28. In an editorial, Ari Serpa-Netto from Monash University, Melbourne, Victoria, Australia, writes that acute hypoxemic respiratory failure remains one of the most common conditions encountered in the intensive care unit. During the past decade, high-flow nasal oxygen has moved from physiological curiosity to frontline therapy. Early enthusiasm followed the publication of the results of the 2015 FLORALI trial, which showed improved survival with high-flow nasal oxygen. Subsequent studies, however, have shown less consistent signals, particularly regarding survival. In parallel, clinical practice shifted toward routine use of high-flow oxygen in patients with hypoxemic respiratory failure, often ahead of definitive evidence regarding its effect on hard outcomes. Against this backdrop, where do the results of this new trial by Fra and co-authors leave the field? Essentially, the trial recalibrates expectations. The use of high-flow oxygen should not be viewed as a mortality-reducing therapy in unselected patients with hypoxemic respiratory failure. Rather, it is a strategy that may meaningfully influence the pathway of respiratory support. For clinicians, this factor reinforces the rationale for early use of high-flow oxygen in appropriate patients while maintaining vigilance for clinical deterioration. For researchers, it underscores the importance of aligning primary outcomes with plausible mechanisms of action and considering composite or hierarchical endpoints that better capture patient-centered benefit. As critical care continues to refine its methodologic standards, the results of this trial stand as a reminder that improving care does not always mean extending life, but sometimes means altering the journey through critical illness in ways that matter deeply to patients and systems alike. All oral treatment of newly diagnosed acute myeloid leukemia by Gail Robos from the New York Presbyterian Hospital and co-authors. For patients with acute myeloid leukemia, AML, who are 75 years of age or older, or who are ineligible for intensive induction chemotherapy, azacitidine or decitabine plus venetoclax is the standard of care, but its need for parenteral administration imposes a burden on both patients and providers. Oral decitabine cetazuridine, approved in Europe for AML, has pharmacokinetic properties equivalent to those of intravenous decitabine, but provides limited survival benefit as monotherapy. In this Phase 1-2 non-randomized trial, 189 patients with newly diagnosed AML who were 75 years of age or older, or who were ineligible for intensive chemotherapy, were assigned to receive oral decitabine cetazuridine plus oral venetoclax. Among these patients, all oral decitabine cetazuridine plus venetoclax caused no reported drug interactions and resulted in a complete response in nearly half the patients, though with myelosuppressive effects. Common adverse events of grade 3 or higher in phase 2b were anemia, neutropenia, and febrile neutropenia. Kidney transplantation in two highly sensitized candidates after CAR T cell therapy by Vijay Bhoj from the University of Pennsylvania, Philadelphia, and co-authors. HLA sensitization poses a major challenge to kidney transplantation for patients with end-stage kidney disease, especially for highly sensitized candidates. Attempts at antibody elimination, desensitization, have had inconsistent efficacy and have often failed to produce sustained reductions in anti-HLA antibodies in patients with the highest level of sensitization, with a calculated panel reactive antibody score of greater than or equal to 99.9%. These investigators now report the results for the safety run-in cohort of a multicenter phase 1 clinical study evaluating the safety and efficacy of combined CD19-targeted and B-cell maturation antigen-targeted CAR T-cells in eliminating the cellular sources of preformed anti-HLA antibodies. Following desensitization with the use of dual CAR T-cell therapy, kidney transplantation was able to take place in two highly sensitized candidates. Neuroepithelial tumor with AAV integration after intracisternal magna vector delivery by Rebecca Ahrens-Nicholas from the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia and co-authors. Recombinant adeno-associated virus, AAV, gene therapy is a promising therapeutic approach for multiple disorders. Recombinant AAV vectors are predominantly non-integrating, but rare genomic integration events have been associated with oncogenesis in neonatal murine models. These investigators report a case of a neuroepithelial tumor that developed in a 5-year-old boy with severe mucopolysaccharidosis type 1, 4 years after intracisternal magna administration of AAV serotype 9 gene therapy. The patient underwent successful resection of the primary neuroepithelial tumor. Postoperatively, he has continued to have advanced cognitive function for his age, a finding that indicates mitigation of mucopolysaccharidosis type 1. Analysis of the tumor tissue showed the integration of rearranged AAV vector elements in the gene PLAG1.
Every day, doctors use medical devices to monitor a patient's health. But what if the device is flawed and gives the wrong vital sign reading because of the color of someone's skin?
Everyone needs to be warned. Every hospital, emergency department, because relying on this device is killing people.
To hear all episodes of The Race Equation from the New England Journal of Medicine, subscribe to Intention to Treat.
Childhood Vaccine Hesitancy, a review article by Sean O'Leary, from the Children's Hospital, Colorado, Aurora, and Margie Danchin from the University of Melbourne, Victoria, Australia. Vaccine hesitancy exists along a spectrum. Most parents with hesitancy are motivated to protect their children, but are often concerned about safety. Routine childhood vaccines recommended by the American Academy of Pediatrics have substantially reduced the incidence of disease and maintain a strong safety record. Clinicians are the most trusted source of vaccine information, and clear, confident recommendations are closely linked to higher uptake. Presumptive communication approaches appear to be more effective than open-ended approaches, especially when paired with respectful dialogue. Empathy-driven, patient-centered strategies, including motivational interviewing, help address concerns, counter misinformation, and build trust while preserving relationships that may encourage future vaccination decisions. The Unusual Suspects, a clinical problem solving by Brittany Bromfield and colleagues. A 53-year-old man with Crohn's disease and psoriasis presented with headache, slurred speech, nausea, vomiting, jaundice, and dark urine after recent travel to the Caribbean. His wife had noticed yellowing of the skin and eyes during the previous 2 weeks. Examination revealed tachycardia, a systolic murmur, splinter hemorrhages, and painful skin lesions suggestive of septic emboli. Laboratory studies showed marked liver injury, and imaging revealed subdural and subarachnoid hemorrhages, cerebral infarcts, and renal infarcts. Blood cultures grew methicillin-sensitive Staph aureus, and echocardiography showed a mitral valve vegetation with severe regurgitation, consistent with infective endocarditis. Although liver function tests initially improved with antibiotics, aminotransferase levels rose again. Liver biopsy showed severe portal and lobular hepatitis with plasma cell infiltration and bridging necrosis, establishing a diagnosis of autoimmune hepatitis that had likely been unmasked by infection and interruption of glucocorticoid therapy. The patient improved with prednisone, azathioprine, antibiotics, and later on, mitral valve replacement. Fasting, glucocorticoids, and breast cancer. A Clinical Implications of Basic Research by Nima Sharifi from the University of Miami Miller School of Medicine. The hormone-sensitive cancers, including breast cancer and prostate cancer, are the most common cancers in the United States. The idea that cancer-associated outcomes can be regulated, at least in part, by fasting and the timing of eating is powerful because it adds a layer of control for patients. One of the many physiological consequences of the fasting state, as compared with the fed state, is the regulation of steroid hormone production by the endocrine organs, and by extension, the exposure of peripheral tissues to hormones and the effects on cell signaling in these tissues. Therefore, the fasting state provides a potential link between a person's modifiable behavior and hormone-sensitive cancer outcomes. Glucocorticoids stimulate the glucocorticoid receptor, a transcription factor that has complex intracellular interactions with other steroid receptors relevant to cancer. These include the androgen receptor and estrogen receptor alpha. A recent study in a mouse model by Padreo et al. Suggests that the activation of glucocorticoid receptors that results from fasting increases the efficacy of hormonal therapy, in this case, tamoxifen, in patients with breast cancer. The results support ongoing work in steroid receptor pharmacology and may inform the design of clinical trials of dietary and fasting interventions in cancer that are accompanied by biologic and biomarker investigations. Regulating corporate control in the U.S. healthcare system. A Perspective on the Corporatization of U.S. Healthcare by Lauren Adler from the Brookings Institution, Washington, D.C. Organization of healthcare delivery in the United States has increasingly become centered around large corporate entities, including hospital systems, insurer-affiliated organizations, and investor-backed firms that concentrate decision-making authority over staffing, contracting, and billing. Corporatization in healthcare isn't a single problem, and it doesn't have a single cause. But predictable harms often arise in circumstances in which market discipline is lacking and policies make consolidation especially profitable. Regulatory responses could therefore focus on making corporatization more visible and corporate players more accountable, preventing anti-competitive consolidation while preserving opportunities for market entry, and addressing policy distortions that advantage consolidation. These steps could make corporatization more likely to deliver on its potential promises and less likely to impose costs that are ultimately borne by patients, clinicians, and communities. War and Famine, a perspective by Kevin Stevenson from Washington University in St. Louis and co-authors. The Integrated Food Security Phase Classification Famine Review Committee concluded in August 2025 that conditions in Gaza met the threshold of famine with reasonable evidence. The metabolic cascade of starvation entails a kind of self-cannibalization to fuel essential processes. Glycogen exhausted within hours. Gluconeogenesis consuming muscle within days. A starving child's immunity collapses with lymphoid organ atrophy, reduced antibody production, and impaired macrophage function. Such immunodeficiency from starvation is as deadly as any induced by chemotherapy, a mutation, or a pandemic virus. Treatments for malnutrition are available. Pediatric severe acute malnutrition can, for instance, be successfully treated outside the hospital with ready-to-use therapeutic food, RUTF, a peanut-based, low-moisture, energy-dense paste. Successful treatment requires identification of cases of wasting, consistent RUTF supply, and clinical follow-up over weeks with serial anthropometric measurements and treatment of intercurrent infections. In its most basic form, identification requires only a tape measure to assess mid-upper arm circumference. But both RUTF supply and continuity of care are disrupted by armed conflict. The prevalence of wasting among children in Gaza tracks with Israeli blockades on aid. Starvation isn't an inevitable consequence of war, but without humanitarian access to therapeutic food, children who could be treated will die. Perversity in medicine. When vocation and corporatization clash. A perspective by Louise Aronson from the University of California, San Francisco. In this age of corporate medicine, when health system leaders say, "We are building the new hospital of the future alongside world-class facilities for biomedical research," Dr. Aronson hears, "We are playing to win in our current medical system rather than innovating to improve it." And when, the situational complexity and their good intentions notwithstanding, they say, "We have acquired two more community-based local hospitals, a move that will allow us to see more patients with complex medical needs at our flagship campus," Dr. Aronson hears, "Having already ghettoized primary care and psychiatry, those desperately needed, health essential, underfunded services into another former community-based hospital where our cultural imperialism has already been established, we are continuing to invade foreign territories in search of locally scarce raw materials and significant captive markets, leaving the colonized literally and culturally impoverished, while increasing our own wealth and power." These are just a couple of the reasons why when Dr. Aronson says, "Most missives from health system leaders strike her as adding insult to injury," Dr. Aronson hopes you hear, she has intentionally ignored the indisputable complexities and laudable goals of some corporate leaders in order to convey her emotional experience as a clinician, patient, and family caregiver. And that when she uses the word perverse in reference to their vision and communications, she uses it in its fundamental sense, to designate a deviation from what is right and good, by which she means an intentional prioritization of business values over the primary mission of medicine and of business leaders' own professional success over potentially risky but desperately needed reforms that aim first and foremost to improve human health. In our images in clinical medicine, a 56-year-old woman presented with a 3-week history of leg swelling. On physical examination, pitting edema in both legs and a milky appearance to the urine were observed. Further testing of the urine identified elevated levels of chylomicrons and an elevated urinary triglyceride level, findings indicative of chylurea. Chylurea results from abnormal communication between the lymphatic and urinary systems. In another image, a 44-year-old man presented with a 4-year history of choking episodes while eating. Endoscopy revealed narrowing of the upper esophagus by a pulsating cord-like structure in the posterior wall, shown in a video at NEJM.org. Following CT of the chest, a diagnosis of dysphagia lusoria, compression of the esophagus by an aberrant right subclavian artery, was made. Although dysphagia lusoria results from a congenital anomaly, it may not cause symptoms until middle age, when vascular stiffening occurs. Read more from our issue at NEJM.org. Let us know what you think about our podcast. Any comments or suggestions may be sent to audio@nejm.org. Thank you for listening.